KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Everything I have done in my life, educationally and professionally, has prepared me for this precise moment in time.
Dr. Oz has gone from daytime TV host to President Trump's nominee to run Medicare and Medicaid.
We'll hear about his confirmation hearing this Friday, March 14th on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, the fight over funding. The government has exposed a divide among Democrats in Congress.
We do not want to shut down the government, but we are not afraid of a government funding showdown.
Also, a gesture that sure looks like a Nazi salute is spreading after Elon Musk did it.
And meet Canada's new Prime Minister, Mark Carney.
We will never, ever, in any way, shape, or form, be part of the United States. America is not Canada.
Plus, a practical approach to dealing with medical debt.
That's ahead. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. In a highly unusual move, President Trump delivered an openly political speech at the Justice Department today. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, it was an airing of grievances and much more.
Just a year ago, Trump was facing charges brought by the Justice Department. Now he's back in office and has scores to settle. During his lengthy remarks at Justice Department headquarters, Trump attacked his perceived enemies and complained about how he has been mistreated.
And I believe that CNN and MSDNC, who literally write 97.6% bad about me, are political arms of the Democrat Party. And in my opinion, they're really corrupt and they're illegal. What they do is illegal.
Presidents have typically tried to avoid any appearance of political interference in the justice system. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The White House.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is demanding remaining Ukrainian forces operating in a border region of Russia lay down their arms. The Kremlin leader presenting the surrender terms as a gesture following a plea by President Trump to spare their lives. More from NPR's Charles Maines.
At issue is the status of Ukrainian forces who launched an incursion into Russia's border region of Kursk 7 months ago. Moscow's had little luck driving them out until recently. Putin says his forces now have the Ukrainians surrounded, a claim Kyiv disputes. Meanwhile, President Trump has called on Putin to spare the lives of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers, something Putin says he would do if Kyiv gives the orders for the men to lay down arms and face justice. Ukraine's toehold in Kursk has emerged an early test of American efforts to negotiate a ceasefire between Moscow and Kyiv, with Russian officials presenting Ukraine's support for the U.S. proposal as a naked bid to prevent the soldiers' demise. Charles Maines, NPR News.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection will be closing down several temporary immigrant processing facilities in Texas. Texas Public Radio's Marion Navarro has details.
CBP reported a steady drop in immigrant encounters along the southwest border, with less than 300 apprehensions per day in February. As a result, CBP says it has officially closed down a temporary tent-like immigrant processing facility in Eagle Pass that it refers to as soft-sided. Agents assigned to the facility will now return to field operations. CBP also plans to close soft-sided facilities in Donna and Laredo, as well as Yuma and Tucson, Arizona. The agency says it now has the full capability to manage the detention of immigrants at its permanent facilities. I'm Marian Navarro in San Antonio.
A closely watched index of consumer sentiment essentially fell off a cliff this month. The University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index for March tumbling 10.5% from the previous month, down 27% from a year ago. You're listening to NPR. Some students at Christian University in southeastern Washington state are protesting after a student was banned from running for student body president, allegedly for being in a same-sex relationship. Northwest Public Broadcasting's Susan Shane has the story.
Walla Walla University is affiliated with the Seventh-day Adventist Church, so the issue falls into a legal gray area, says Jenny Pizer. She's the legal director at Lambda Legal, a nonprofit focused on LGBTQ rights. Either way, recent cuts to the agency that oversees Title IX violations mean that enforcement could be hard to come by. Here's Pizer.
If there's no civil rights enforcers, there's no Department of Education, it's all now become a sort of a vacuum.
In an email, a Walla Walla University representative said campus leaders must advocate for and model Seventh-day Adventist beliefs and behaviors. For NPR News, I'm Susan Shane in College Place, Washington.
Florida citrus growers have been dealing with a 1-2 punch. Not only have recent hurricanes caused damage, but disease has also ravaged the state's signature crop. Many citrus growers are simply giving up, saying they intend to sell their groves rather than wait for the development of genetically modified trees. The downturn in the citrus industry is something of a boon for real estate developers, though. Florida has the third largest population of all U.S. states, growing by 450,000 plus people last year. Stocks rallied to their best day since November's election, though it still was not enough to recover from a fourth straight losing week. The Dow is up 674 points. The NASDAQ rose 451 points. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
On a Friday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Dr. Mehmet Oz was on Capitol Hill today. He is President Trump's nominee to run the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And, of course, he's also the star of the long-running TV program, The Dr. Oz Show. In his opening statement before senators, he said he's ready for this very different job.
Everything I have done in my life, educationally and professionally, has prepared me for this precise moment in time.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin was watching that confirmation hearing and is in the studio at this precise moment in time. Hi, Selena.
Hi, Ari.
Before we dig into the hearing, tell us about that background Oz was talking about.
Right. So Oz is a medical doctor. He's a cardiothoracic surgeon. He also went to business school. You mentioned his TV show, which ran for years. Trump was a guest on that show. So was Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who will be Oz's boss if he's confirmed. And over the years, Oz got into some hot water for products he promoted on that show, especially miraculous weight loss products. In 2021, he moved into politics for a Senate run as the Republican candidate in Pennsylvania, and he narrowly lost that race.
And tell us about what he'd be responsible for at the agency that he is nominated to run.
So it's the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, part of the Department of Health and Human Services. It's usually an agency that's kind of behind the scenes, but it has a huge budget, over $1 trillion. It runs Medicare and the Affordable Care Act marketplace, healthcare.gov. It also oversees Medicaid, which is the joint state and federal health insurance program for low-income people. So altogether, it provides health coverage for nearly half the country.
And how did his confirmation hearing at the Finance Committee go?
Well, Oz seemed poised. Obviously, he's comfortable in the spotlight. He bantered with senators on both sides of the aisle about potato chips with Chair Mike Crapo of Idaho and going to church with Senator Warnock of Georgia. And the hearing was pretty friendly overall, much friendlier than the hearings for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who was really skewered by Democratic senators for his past controversial statements and views. Now, Oz did receive some questions about the dubious weight loss products, but not much, barely anything about his financial ties to health companies, including insurers. Basically, there wasn't a huge focus on what he's done in the past, more on the issues facing CMS and what he would do about them.
You mentioned the huge budget this agency has. It's also facing big cuts as Republican lawmakers look for ways to pay for President Trump's tax cut plan. How would that affect the programs?
Yeah, so Medicaid in particular is a big political hot topic, not in today's spending fight to keep the government open, but in the future budget battle. Republican lawmakers' budget outline would cut $880 billion, likely from Medicaid. The details of how they would get all those cuts are not clear. And Democratic members of this committee did press Oz on this. Here's Senator Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire asking whether he would support cuts that analysts say would lead to people losing their Medicaid coverage, including children.
Senator Hazard, I've not seen the details of a House bill that says that. I look forward to examining it with great care, if confirmed by this.
So let me ask it another way. How many children losing health insurance would be acceptable to you?
I don't want children losing health insurance.
Well, then you're going to need to reject the Republican budget plan.
Now, Oz is not in charge of the budget process, of course. That's a job for Congress. But it's going to be a long, tough process. And there is a big advocacy effort to stop any cuts to Medicaid.
And what's next for his confirmation?
Well, it seems at this point that it's pretty likely that he will be confirmed. It could be a bipartisan vote. That hasn't been scheduled yet. Probably this is a big relief to President Trump and Secretary Kennedy, who suffered a big setback this week when they had to pull the CDC nominee because he didn't have enough support for confirmation.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin, thank you.
Thank you.
In a low-key ceremony today in Ottawa, Mark Carney was sworn in as Canada's new prime minister.
I, Mark Carney, do solemnly and sincerely promise and swear that I will truly and faithfully...
59. He is replacing Justin Trudeau, who led Canada for almost a decade before stepping aside in January. And Carney is picking up the reins just as Canada is embroiled in a trade war with the U.S. NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam reports.
Mark Carney becomes prime minister at a particularly low point in U.S.-Canada relations. President Trump launched what Carney calls unjustified punishing tariffs on Canada. Carney acknowledged this new reality during his acceptance speech as head of the governing Liberal Party last weekend.
I know that these are dark days. Dark days brought on by a country we can no longer trust.
Carney's immediate focus will be on U.S. tariffs and the broadening trade war. For that, he has a background in finance. He spent time on Wall Street. He was the governor of the Bank of England, and Carney headed up the Bank of Canada.
Carney is very experienced in terms of dealing with a wide range of personalities and different economic spheres.
Charles Bird is with Earnscliffe Strategies, a public affairs firm in Canada. He says while Justin Trudeau and Trump did not get along, Carney could represent a fresh start for the relationship.
I think he is much more inclined to speak the language of Donald Trump, which is much more about business and economics and deal-making.
Bird says Carney will need to be diplomatic and know when to be tough, such as at a press conference today. Carney called Trump's threat to make Canada the 51st state, quote, crazy.
We will never, ever, in any way, shape, or form, be part of the United States. America is not Canada.
Carney is expected to quickly announce general elections for late April or May. He's never held public office, and many Canadians never heard of him until a few weeks ago. But Dimitri Anastakis, a history professor at the University of Toronto, says Carney's main opposition, Pierre Poilievre with the Conservative Party, is widely seen by many as a Canadian version of Trump, which has dented his poll numbers.
And this has really helped the Liberals. It's certainly helped Carney. And it's really had an impact, a unifying impact in Canada.
Anastakis says one thing of note is Carney's first trip as prime minister. He's going to Europe.
From a historical perspective, it has been an expectation that the first stop would be Washington. Carney is really sending a message here in terms of that shift of where the allies and allyship lies.
Carney says he has no plans for now to go to the U.S. to speak with Trump. The president has yet to congratulate Carney. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
As Europe questions whether it can still rely on the United States and the war in Ukraine rages to the east, Germany is planning to end years of fiscal prudence to beef up its meager military and kickstart its stagnant economy. But Conservative leader Friedrich Merz, who is not yet chancellor, must clear a number of hurdles before he can start spending. Esme Nicholson reports.
As lawmakers in the Bundestag jeered and gesticulated, Chancellor-in-waiting Friedrich Merz defended his motion to free up defense spending from Germany's strict laws that constrain borrowing.
The hybrid war already being waged against us has escalated massively in the past few weeks, from drones flying over barracks to attacks on our infrastructure. The threat to our security is greater than ever. We must act now and without delay to increase our defense capabilities.
Merz also justified plans to borrow $550 billion to invest in the country's crumbling infrastructure on top of unlimited defense spending, made urgent by the fear that the US will no longer support Ukraine or protect Europe in NATO. It marks a fiscal policy U-turn for a country historically allergic to debt and signals just how rattled Berlin is by apparent chaos in the White House. It's also a bid to revive Germany's sluggish economy. Jens Zuderkorn is one of the economists who drew up the plan for Merz.
For a long time, we run budget surpluses year after year. The German debt to GDP ratio is much lower than in the US. Now we have to invest, and really quickly, because the world around us has changed dramatically within the last weeks.
To reform the constitutionally enshrined limits on debt and start spending more, Merz needs a two-thirds majority. This is why he is pushing for a vote in the outgoing Bundestag before the newly elected lower house convenes later this month, when the far left and the far right will have enough seats to block it. Alice Weidel, co-chair of the Far Right Alternative for Germany, or AfD, accused Merz of playing dirty.
Dieses Vorgehen zeugt.
By attempting to box through this motion with the help of lawmakers who've been voted out shows your contempt for the will of the electorate and your disdain for democracy.
Merz's main concern, though, was the Green Party, whose lawmakers were driving a hard bargain in exchange for their vote. Liana Fix from the Council on Foreign Relations says Merz, who has never held a government post, is getting a crash course on political compromise.
The kind of political statecraft that you need to get everyone on board for this is something that Friedrich Merz has not a lot of experience with. In the past, he has often pursued an approach of my way or the highway.
Even if the motion passes and allows the future government to whip out the checkbook, some worry that red tape could get in the way, something Jens Zuderkorn has made clear to Merz.
The crucial step is to make sure that all of this money turns into better roads, better bridges, better military equipment, more soldiers, and eventually then also into more economic growth.
Liana Fix says Germany's armed forces are so chronically underfunded, they've forgotten how to spend money.
Now that Europeans have seen how quickly equipment from the United States can be turned off in Ukraine, there are concerns that it might be in the future risky to buy too much from the United States.
She says money spent on weapons made in Germany must be for things like drones, not the usual overly complex systems favoured here that are obsolete by the time they hit the market. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The COVID pandemic affected every aspect of society, and that included the movies we watched, how we watched those movies, as well as the movies that got made or didn't get made. So as we mark 5 years since the COVID shutdowns, we want to bring in two people at NPR who I know spent a lot of that time watching movies, and that is NPR critic Bob Bondello. Hey, Bob.
Hi, good to be here.
And All Things Considered producer Mark Rivers. Hey, Mark.
Hey there, Scott.
What do you remember about those early months when it came to movies? So, like, movies specifically, no Tiger King.
Yeah. Only thing I know is that maybe a person got eaten by a tiger. I still, to this day, have not watched Tiger King. For me, I kind of dove right into, you know, I wanted to watch movies that can kind of reflect feelings of isolation and, mm-hmm. and the fear and paranoia we all felt. I know, weird.
Ouch.
I'm more
that
like,
is horrible.
I want the movie.
There wasn't enough out there. You said needed more.
I want to watch a movie and be like, do you understand what I'm going through? Do you see me in this moment? And honestly, one of those movies for me was John Carpenter's The Thing. If we're talking isolated, okay. There's a virus going around, we don't know who has it.
We're going to draw a little bit of everybody's blood. Because we're going to find out who's the thing.
You can't escape from where you are. That movie was felt very COVID-coded. Another movie that I think we could all relate to, Groundhog Day.
Feel like you were just reliving the same day over and over and over
and
again.
And we didn't even have the luxury of being with Punxsutawney Phil to do that as well. I mean, I think there's one scene in that movie where Bill Murray's kind of deep into the cycle that I think kind of clearly lays out what we were all feeling.
What would you do if you were stuck in one place and every day was exactly the same and nothing that you did mattered?
That sums it up for me.
I think that sums it up for all of us. That sums it up for a lot of us.
It's true.
Which way did you lean, Bob?
I was really trying to escape. Don't forget, I'm still a critic, and so I'm still...
You had a job to do.
Yeah, there were people sending me movies that they were putting out there to mm-hmm. the world. So I was still seeing a lot of films, and some of them had something to do with it. There was a movie called Language Lessons that had Mark Duplass and Natalie Morales. It was about a guy who gets a gift of 100 language lessons online. Mm-hmm. And so the premise of it allowed them to film it in separate places.
How does this whole thing work since we're like, you know, this way?
Bueno, hablamos en español.
Oh, I don't know if he told you, but I'm not fluent in Spanish. I'm not very good. So do we have to?
See?
What I gravitated to other than that was things that made me comfortable. Yeah. The isolation one that makes me comfortable is Harold and Maude.
Mm.
I just love that movie, and it's about a kid who is just completely separate from the rest of the world and can't deal with
it. He did not need a pandemic to be
he was socially isolated no matter what, and I sort of lived that. And then I guess I watched a whole bunch of Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies.
Yeah.
Because on the theory that, you know, they dance us out of the depression. Mm-hmm. Now they could dance us through this somehow.
I definitely leave comfort movies too. Early on, I have this memory of just like seeing on Netflix that the original Space Jam had just been posted and just like sitting on the floor like in a ball watching Space Jam.
A good reminder that you are a millennial. I forget sometimes.
Bugs Bunny.
You were expecting maybe the Easter Bunny?
You're a cartoon. You're not real.
What you guys are describing is exactly what the public did generally, though.
Yeah.
I mean, they started watching old things that made them comfortable in some mm-hmm. way. And all the streaming services got wind of that really quickly or realized and sort of pushed it. And so we all got into streaming.
And yet, they were still trying to make movies.
Yes.
And there were some cartoonish attempts to do that. And there are some attempts that were kind of smart. And Bob, walk us through how the movie industry responded, because the basic premise of making a movie is a lot of people show up in the same space and spend a lot of time together. And that was very hard to do in 2020 and 2021.
This is true. The big example that made headlines when The Sun reported it, they were making a Mission Impossible movie then. And an incident on the set. My understanding is that two of the employees there were standing closer than the protocols called for. They were standing together at a computer terminal, and Tom Cruise saw them, and he said this.
We are not shutting this f***ing movie down! Is it understood? If I see it again, you're f***ing gone, and so are you. So you're going to cost him his job.
When you care about movies the way Tom Cruise cares about movies, this is what you get. This is what happens.
But in fairness, what he said was, look, I think about this every day. There are thousands of people whose jobs depended on this. Mm-hmm. You know, people are going to lose their homes. Mm-hmm. And that's real. I mean, the whole industry shut down. The industry stopped.
One of the movies that was supposed to, you know, save the movie theaters was Christopher Nolan's Tenet.
And that is Tenet, the first blockbuster to hit theaters in months. Movie theater chains are really banking on it to bring back the crowds.
Now, I remember the screening. They had it in an IMAX theater that seated something like 450 people. And there were six other critics and me. And they had staked out seats that were as far apart from each other as we could be. So I'm watching this movie in late summer thinking, this cannot be the future of movie going.
And also, what is this plot?
And also, it wasn't a very good movie. I disagree. It was a wonderful movie.
Bob, I love that. Is that the COVID fog speaking right now?
Yes, very much. Okay. It's just a wonderful movie.
Wonderful movie or not. It did not save the movie theaters. And it forced Warner Brothers, or it made them decide to, they were going to just release their movie simultaneously in theaters and streaming.
Bob, when did you start noticing COVID showing up as a plot point, as an atmosphere of the movies?
When did I first notice it? It might have been, this was a Netflix movie, but The Glass Onion?
Yeah.
Right? That felt like a COVID party.
I mean,
right?
they had to quarantine together, right?
It's the premise of a rich, extravagant COVID quarantine
Agatha
situation.
Christie-esque this is Knives Out movie.
And they all showed up in masks, right? Mm-hmm. Onto this island, and then they were isolated, and then they could go on with the plot.
I think I was more interested in the movies that were approaching COVID almost like atmospherically, not like kind of head on, but as a way to kind of inform kind of the emotional reality of these movies. I mean, a kind of an early one that I remember from 2021, funny enough, was M. Night Shyamalan's Old, which was one of the first movies I saw in the theater since the shutdown started.
What happened to her?
Body has decomposed.
How quickly can that happen?
7 years.
But she just died.
Wait.
And if you think about that movie where these people are trapped on this island and people are aging rapidly and no one knows what's happening, no one knows what's going on, I feel like people could relate to that, where all of a sudden you blink and a year, 2 years have gone by. Mm-hmm. I feel like especially people with kids could relate to that feeling. And, you know, a Shyamalan movie these days will have actors kind of talking and delivering dialogue as if they've been lobotomized. I think that was also appropriate.
Because you think
about returning back to, communal spaces. We didn't know how to talk to each other. We talked about how we discovered how to bake bread or about what our pet was eating.
Oh, yeah. I remember being like very like awkwardly sweaty the first time. No one knew how to talk.
So I think Old captured that.
Yeah.
We're still kind of coming to grips with what we experienced, what we went through. And I think we'll probably see more movies in the future that are trying to like make sense of the pandemic in their own kind of distinctive ways. But I think the emotional fallout of the pandemic, we still haven't truly or fully grappled with.
That is NPR's Bob Mondello and Mark Rivers. Thanks to both of you.
Great fun.
Thanks, guys.
This is NPR News.
Massachusetts was one of the first places to establish a state lottery. Bureaucrats wanted to raise money for the state and...
The other key rationale in getting these lotteries created was to put the mob out of business.
I'm Rob Schmitz. We dig into the history of the mob versus the Massachusetts state lottery on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, New York's governor is choosing her battles with the president.
She doesn't want to be seen to be an ally of Donald Trump and his administration. She also has to worry about her left flank and being seen as too liberal.
After the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump's efforts to dismantle the Department of Education continues to be met with intense backlash. NPR's Windsor Johnson tells us more than a dozen Democratic-led states have filed legal action against laying off half of the agency's staff.
The Department of Education has already closed 7 of its 12 civil rights offices, including its location in San Francisco. That office supported students with disabilities and those facing harassment based on race, ethnicity, and gender. Critics argue that only Congress has the authority to abolish an agency like the DHS, stressing the department's role in protecting the health, safety, and education of children, especially kids from low-income families. The administration's efforts fulfill a long-expressed Republican goal, but have also sparked widespread protests across the nation and debates over the future of education policy and civil rights protections. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
A massive storm system sweeping across the country could unleash tornadoes in the South. Alabama's governor has declared a state of emergency ahead of this weekend's storm. From member station WBHM, Kelsey Shelton reports.
This severe weather is part of a large storm system that the National Weather Service says will affect 100 million people. The system pushes farther south on Saturday into the Gulf Coast states. Areas with the greatest risk include parts of eastern Louisiana and much of Mississippi and Alabama. The worst of the weather will begin Saturday afternoon and continue into the night. Fast-moving storms could cause wind gusts of up to 100 miles per hour and baseball-sized hail. Forecasters say it's even possible for the dreaded long-track tornado to touch down. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey says although the state is no stranger to Mother Nature's wrath, Alabamians need to start being vigilant now. For NPR News, I'm Kelsey Shelton in Birmingham.
And you're listening to NPR. Israeli forces arrested more than 100 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank this week. The Israeli military says it's part of a, quote, counter-terrorism operation. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
In addition to the arrests, the Israeli military also questioned dozens of Palestinians, who it called, quote, terror suspects, as part of its ongoing campaign in the northern West Bank, which has lasted almost 2 months and displaced tens of thousands of Palestinians from their homes. More than 650 Palestinians have been arrested in the operation, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Commission, which says Israel has, quote, escalated arrests in recent months. The detentions have been happening as around 2,000 Palestinians were released from Israeli jails as part of the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas since January. Most were sent to Gaza, but several hundred returned to the West Bank, roughly the same number that Israel has arrested in that time frame. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
In Oregon, police say more shots were fired at a Tesla dealership and ongoing vandalism since Elon Musk began advising President Trump. Police say over a dozen shots were fired into a Portland dealership overnight, causing extensive damage to cars and showroom windows. No injuries were reported, but it was the second incident at the Tesla dealership in a week. The company has seen its stock value cut in half since Musk took point on the arbitrary firings of some 20,000 federal workers. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. They cut it close, but facing a midnight deadline, Congress has managed to avoid a government shutdown. The Republican-led Senate, with help from some Democrats, passed a stopgap bill tonight to fund the government through September. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has been under fire for his role in that vote, though he argued the focus should stay on the president.
Donald Trump owns the chaos in government. He owns the chaos in the stock market. He owns the damage happening to the economy.
Many Democrats, though, have turned their fury on Schumer, saying he caved to Trump. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales is tracking this. Claudia, we meet again.
We meet again.
Okay, so as we were noting on the program yesterday, Republicans needed Democrats to get this done in the Senate. And for much of this week, it didn't look like they were going to help. What changed?
Right, a lot. We saw a dramatic reversal of Democratic momentum to stop this bill. Many saw this as a moment of leverage. So while Leader Schumer initially said the GOP did not have the votes, he reversed course the next day to say the alternative was a shutdown and no exit strategy, and concerns that the Trump administration would ramp up their dismantling of the federal government. So a reminder, in the Senate, there's a 60-vote threshold to overcome the filibuster. Republicans only have 53 seats. And Democrats had to provide those remaining votes. They were opposed to this bill because they were not part of the negotiations, and it's going to force some dramatic cuts for some federal programs. That left Senate Democrats deeply divided. And now Schumer and likely these 10 Democrats are going to face a new wrath from their party. It's a continuation of this growing anger from their base, who say the party's been asleep at the wheel while President Trump moves at a breakneck speed.
Now, the action today is on the House side, is on the Senate side, whereas on the House side, Democrats had stayed largely united. They voted against this plan. How are they responding to today's developments?
Right. They feel betrayed by Schumer and these other Democrats who voted yes. Some of these members in the House who voted against this bill were in Trump won districts, so it was a big political risk for them to vote against this. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries earlier today in a spectacular moment was asked by reporters if it's time for new leadership in the Senate, and he responded by saying, next question. This is how he framed where Democrats in the House stood on the threat of a government shutdown.
We are not afraid of a government funding showdown, and we will win that showdown. Because we stand on the side of the American people.
And he wasn't alone.
Claudia, are any Democrats defending Schumer?
Yes, in some cases. Most Democratic senators I talked to today told me he should remain in his leadership post. It was stunning, however, that there were some that were not ready to back Schumer. For example, I talked to freshman Senator Ruben Gallego of Arizona, and he said this is a moment for the party to have a conversation. And so he didn't quite run out and say no, that it's not an option for him to be backing down from leadership.
All of this seems to be adding up to a very good week for Republicans on Capitol Hill. What are they planning next?
Right. It's a reminder. This is the most united Republican Party we've ever seen with President Trump. Now they turn to a massive partisan policy plan. This involves extending a tax program that was passed under Trump's first term, wide-ranging new policies on the border. So another opportunity for new wins.
And NPR's Claudia Grisales reporting from the Capitol. Thank you.
Thank you.
New York's Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul is trying to navigate tensions with President Trump. They met privately today in the White House, a day after Trump called Hochul a, quote, very nice woman. They have also clashed on the issues facing New York. Jung Yoon Han of the New York Public News Network reports on the fine line Hochul's walking.
Governor Kathy Hochul requested the meeting this week. But at times, she has referenced the Rambo movies to describe her approach to President Donald Trump's administration.
Everybody watch First Blood? Someone draws First Blood?
You respond. I didn't draw first blood. Okay.
Hochul hasn't confronted Trump quite like some other Democratic governors. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker compared the president's first weeks in office to the end of democracy in pre-war Germany. Maine Governor Janet Mills told Trump, "See you in court," at a White House meeting.
She's playing the game a little bit differently.
That's Grant Reher. He's a politics professor at Syracuse University.
She doesn't want to be seen to be an ally of Donald Trump and his administration. She also has to worry about her left flank and being seen as too liberal.
And he says Hochul has to worry about things like federal money. So she's been choosing her battles. One fight she's taken up is a congestion pricing law that charged tolls on drivers in lower Manhattan. Trump revoked federal approval for it after he came into office. That drew a lawsuit from the Transport Authority and Hochul's criticism.
New York hasn't labored under a king in over 250 years. And we are not. We sure as hell are not going to start now.
Hochul's defense of the policy is building goodwill with environmentalists and transit advocates. She's also said the tariffs that Trump says are needed to support U.S. business could cost the average New Yorker as much as $1,200 annually.
This is literally just the beginning of what we're going to be feeling as a result of this administration.
But she's been cautious about confronting Trump on positions that might be more controversial, especially around immigration. She did not remove New York Mayor Eric Adams from office, despite corruption allegations and as some Democrats wanted. Adams has cooperated with Trump's crackdown on immigration, which Reher says strikes a chord on concerns over public safety.
That fits exactly into that narrative where she is already seen she is politically vulnerable.
State Republicans are amplifying the public safety claims, though immigrant advocates say they're not proven. Immigration advocates like Murata Wauda, the president and CEO of the New York Immigration Coalition, want Hochul to stand up to Trump on immigration.
While it's been great seeing Governor Hochul fight back against Donald Trump, we'd love for her to also support protecting our communities here across the state of New York, like supporting the New York For All Act.
The New York For All Act would prohibit state and local officials from working with immigration and customs enforcement officials over deportations. The bill has been around for a couple years. In a written statement, Hochul's office said the governor will consider the bill if it's passed first by state lawmakers. For now, she says New York will work with ICE for migrants who've committed crimes. Morgan Hook, who's a Democratic strategist in New York, thinks immigration will be the biggest issue out of Washington that Hochul will have to address. The question then is, will she listen to progressive Democrats or voters who want more immigration enforcement?
I think that we've already seen Governor Hochul take action that demonstrates that she's trying to align herself more with, I would say, middle-of-the-road voters, swing voters, moderate voters.
Hochul is up for re-election next year, and she does have some leverage with Trump. Trump said he wanted to use the meeting with Hochul on Friday to talk about a natural gas pipeline he wants to run through the state. Hochul said she revisited the question of congestion pricing in New York City. A statement from her office called the meeting a productive conversation. For NPR News, I'm Jung Yoon Han in Albany, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered. President Trump paid a visit to the Justice Department today. Just a year ago, he was facing criminal charges from that department. Today, speaking to DOJ leaders, the FBI director, employees, invited guests, Trump vowed a renewed Justice Department and aggressive law enforcement. He also talked about retribution, and he noted how rare it is for a sitting president to make such an address.
This has been a great honor. I was asked to do it, and I said, is it appropriate that I do it? And then I realized it's not only appropriate, I think it's really important, and I may never do it again.
NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keefe is with me to discuss this. Hey, Tam.
Hi.
What struck you from the president's speech?
You know, in many ways, this was a typical Trump campaign speech.
long, meandering, full of attacks on his perceived enemies and complaints about how he's been mistreated. There was some 2020 election denialism sprinkled on top for good measure. But this wasn't a mid-sized arena in a swing state. This was the Department of Justice, a place that presidents have typically stayed away from to avoid even a whiff of politics interfering with the rule of law. But this is President Trump, who believes that the Justice Department was weaponized against him during the Biden administration, and now he is back in office and has scores to settle.
So now, as the chief law enforcement officer in our country, I will insist upon and demand full and complete accountability for the wrongs and abuses that have occurred. The American people have given us a mandate like few people thought possible. We want every single swing state.
At least twice in the speech, he listed people, lawyers who appear on TV or work for Democratic politicians, who he called radicals, scum, and really bad people. It was, in essence, an enemies list.
Tim, you said the speech was long. It was meandering. Did he meander into any of the other subjects he likes to talk about, aside from law enforcement, things like tariffs, immigration?
Yep. Immigration and drugs is what the White House said he would talk about. And he did get to that. Attorney General Pam Bondi, who introduced him, stuck largely to immigration and drug enforcement, talking about the deadly and potent drug fentanyl. And at one point, President Trump brought up to the microphone a mother whose son loved Donald Trump, she said, and who overdosed on fentanyl. Trump said it was families like hers that he's fighting for, and tied this to his escalating trade wars with Mexico and Canada. And at the very end, he announced he would be launching a new anti-drug campaign that would emphasize the effects some drugs have on your physical appearance. He said he wished he could use the death penalty to fight drugs like they do in China and Singapore, but said the American people aren't ready for that.
Back to the setting that he was addressing the nation's chief law enforcement agency, I was struck by the fact that he used the word illegal, and he used it more than once. Would you explain the significance?
Yeah, he was suggesting that news coverage that includes criticism of the judges and justices he appointed, or even that quotes legal experts weighing in on cases, amounted to interference, and said it should be illegal. He said it nearly a dozen times. He called out news organizations by name. Saying something should be illegal while at the Justice Department gives it a different weight. And this comes in the context of numerous moves by the Trump administration in his short time in office that raise serious First Amendment questions.
That's NPR's Tamara Keith. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Elon Musk's stiff-armed salute on Inauguration Day sparked days of debate. Was it a Nazi salute or just an awkward arm flail? What did he mean by it? Here's what's not up for debate. In the weeks since, at least a dozen other people have tried out the gesture publicly. Some have lost jobs, but for others, nothing's changed. NPR's Lisa Hagen reports on what's happening and why some people think it's a joke.
The stiff arm salute used to have a very narrow meaning.
I think generally most people still find the Sieg Heil to be reminiscent of World War II, the Holocaust.
Kurt Braddock is a communications professor at American University who studies extremism.
It signifies that somebody is, if not physically and socially part of a far-right neo-Nazi group, then they at least ideologically align with them.
But after Elon Musk faced no serious consequences for his Inauguration Day salutes, the gesture's meaning, like it or not, began to shift for some people. Musk himself has made jokes after the public outcry, most recently on Joe Rogan's podcast. Things like making puns with the names of Nazi leaders like Joseph Goebbels.
I did not see it coming. It's classic. People will Goebbels anything down.
Prominent figures on the right have also mimicked Musk's salute with no apparent repercussions, including Steve Bannon and another speaker at the Conservative Political Action Conference. In other cases, people less insulated by power have lost their jobs, including Friar Calvin Robinson, a priest in Michigan who capped off an anti-abortion speech with the salute. He very clearly described it as a joke on his YouTube show.
Yes, it was cheeky. I am cheeky, first and foremost, but it wasn't immoral. It wasn't unethical.
Robinson didn't respond to an interview request. He lost his license to minister to Anglican Catholic churches and then had his U.S. visa temporarily revoked. He has said he's not a Nazi and he's not sorry. Robinson isn't the only example of people grinning as they do these salutes. So how did we get here? Why do people think throwing what to many looks like a Nazi salute is a joke? Nick Butler is the author of The Trouble with Jokes, a book about offensive humor. He teaches at Stockholm University.
A joke is kind of like a sonar. It emits a pulse and, you know, listens out for laughter and detects affinities among those who laugh at it.
That's how jokes create in-groups and out-groups. You're either laughing or you're not. Butler says humor is a tool. It can be used by anyone.
I think some have tried to kind of put boundaries between, okay, well, this we can call humor because it punches up rather than punches down. But if someone is laughing, then we have to accept that it is a joke of some kind.
He says offensive humor also lays a trap for anyone who's uncomfortable when a joke smashes through a social taboo.
You can accuse them of being oversensitive. You can accuse them of being an insufferable killjoy. And no one wants to be an insufferable killjoy.
Ridiculing critics as humorless is a strategy that's been cultivated for years by popular figures on the right.
Saying, hey, come over here, we're the fun ones.
That's Nick Marks, a media studies professor at Colorado State University, who's been studying right-wing comedy. He says blending politics with the ambiguity of jokes is all part of a bigger permission structure that Donald Trump has built over years.
That sort of tendency to just blurt out freeform whatever's on his mind, and we've seen that excuse on his behalf a handful of times. Well, clearly President Trump was just joking. I think now you see that sensibility playing out pretty routinely among his inner circle and his representatives.
He predicts we'll continue to see people experimenting with what you can and can't get away with. The salutes are an extreme example of that. They're also constitutionally protected speech. But Braddock, the extremism researcher, says regular people will likely face more repercussions than the elites they may be imitating.
It's not going to matter to your employer. And unfortunately, it's not going to matter to the hardline neo-Nazis who are looking for an excuse to normalize their ideologies and begin engaging in violence.
He says it'll remain useful to highlight examples of people facing real consequences for doing the salutes, regardless of their intent. Lisa Hagen, NPR News.
In the U.S., medical debt as a whole is over $200 billion, which sounds overwhelming. So today we are taking a practical approach to the topic because there's a well-kept secret about the astronomical dollar amounts on your medical bills.
They're fake numbers. They can be negotiated.
That is Jared Walker, founder of the nonprofit Dollar Four. He says these bills also can be inaccurate, and you may not have to pay them at all, depending on your income. Life Kit host Marielle Segata has more.
Walker says when you get a medical bill, the first thing you should do is find out if you qualify for something called charity care. Under federal law, nonprofit hospitals are required to have these policies.
To keep their nonprofit status, they have to provide free or reduced care to patients within a certain income range. Typically, a policy will say something like, if you're at or below, 300% of the federal poverty guideline, then you're eligible for free care or reduced care.
Unfortunately, nothing about this process is straightforward. The income cutoff for charity care can be different depending on the hospital and sometimes the state you're in. Also, your hospital may not volunteer that you're even eligible for charity care. To find out more, do a web search for your hospital name plus the phrase financial assistance and find the application.
Typically, it's like two pages. Who are you? Who do you live with? Where do you work? How much money do you make? And it's like, then prove it. Proof of income, pay stubs, tax return, all that. So you fill all that out and submit it to the hospital through whatever wacky way they do that, typically through fax or mail or whatever. And then you can wait a couple weeks and then just check in as often as you like. I typically bother them a lot about it.
By the way, for-profit hospitals often have these policies as well, though they're not required to by federal law. If you don't qualify for charity care, the next step is to ask the hospital for an itemized bill and take a look at everything on it. Did you actually have that procedure done? Walker says it's common to find errors. You may also find things on your bill that are accurate, but seem like an overcharge, like $100 for a couple bandages or aspirin. Take note of those and bring them up to the billing office. Even if your bill is technically correct, you can negotiate. One way to do that, if you have savings and you can afford to pay something up front, call the billing office and ask, what's the settlement amount?
Like, what will you take right now if I can close out this account? Typically, we can get 30 to 50% off just by asking that. If I pay you right now, what can I get lowered off this bill?
If you can't afford this approach, you can still negotiate. Ask what they can do to lower the bill. And you can get on a payment plan. That's typically better than putting the debt on your credit card because often hospitals will not charge interest. Lastly, remember that this is a long game. You may not get anywhere with the first couple calls, but keep plugging away at it or ask a family member or friend to help you follow up. And keep in mind that while medical bills may seem urgent, especially when they say due upon receipt, you have a lot of time before they're sent to collections or they affect your credit.
There's no like sense of urgency. You have to pay this now. You can take a deep breath, get a plan, and go from there.
For NPR News, I'm Marielle Segarra.
And for more Life Kit, you can go to npr.org/lifekit.
Have a great weekend. It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive, Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. From EasyCater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. Thank you.